it was a period in which almost everybody in the present situation regards as a dark time, in which the CIA played a major role.
That's right.
Dwayne Claridge.
They played a major role in overthrowing, what's his name?
What's his name was Salvador Allende.
Yeah, fine. Okay.
He was democratically elected.
Right. Okay.
Is that okay to overthrow a democratically elected government? Is it okay?
It depends on what your national security interests are.
Are you denying that Pinochet caused huge suffering in that country?
I don't buy. That he committed crimes, I agree.
But it's worth it.
Huh?
Is that what you're saying? Yes, those crimes are worth it.
Yeah. Sometimes, unfortunately, things have to be changed in a rather ugly way.
Levantate y mira la montaña, de donde viene el viento, el sol y el agua. Que manejas el curso de los ríos.
By the late 70s, most of Latin America was controlled by dictators, including those like Pinochet, who were openly fascist. All of them were backed, directly and indirectly, by the United States. They sent their henchmen to be trained here, at the School of the Americas in Georgia. Officially, it was described as little more than a Boy Scout camp, teaching American values such as respect for human rights. In fact, from these manuals were taught interrogation and torture techniques. Major Joseph Blair taught at the School of the Americas in the early 1980s.
The doctrine that was taught was that if you want information, you use physical abuse, you use false imprisonment, you use threats to family members, you use virtually any method necessary to get what you want.
Torture?
And killing.
Killing?
Killing. If there's someone you don't want, you kill them. If you can't get the information you want, if you can't get that person to shut up or stop what they're doing, you simply assassinate them, and you assassinate them with one of your death squads.
This is a death squad in action in El Salvador. Actually, it's the national police, many of whom were trained at the School of the Americas. Here on the steps of San Salvador Cathedral, they're gunning down mourners attending the funeral of Archbishop Romero, who was murdered, as he said, Mass on March the 23rd, 1980. This man, Robert Daubuisson, gave the order to kill the Archbishop. Major Daubuisson was Washington's dirty secret in El Salvador. He was trained at the School of the Americas. According to the Truth Commission and a whole swathe of human...
Where we're going, you're wasting my time. All bullshit. Those people all had agendas.
So it was bullshit that the Salvadorian military were murdering tens of thousands of people.
I bet you can't count more than 200 in the whole 10 or 12 years.
We can count 200 in this one village alone. They were mostly women and children, systematically murdered in just one day and night in December 1981 in the village of El Mazote. The killers belonged to a special battalion of the El Salvador Army trained by the United States. There were few survivors.
Rufina Amaya, El Mazote survivor.
Que las mujeres se abrazaban llorando y gritando que no las mataran.
I saw the women clinging to each other, crying and screaming at them not to kill them. I fought for my children. I didn't want to let them go. I said I would die with them, but they wrenched them from my arms. We heard them killing the children. They killed them at night. You heard their screams for their mothers and fathers.
You're taking the stuff from these propaganda mills.
Dwayne Claridge.
And I'm not interested.
What are the propaganda mills?
All these things, this truth thing and all that. They're nothing but propaganda mills.
Do you really think
that? I know so.
Are they all conning us, lying us? Yeah, Amnesty International?
Amnesty International is right in the middle of it.
During the 1980s, the years of Ronald Reagan in the White House, a trail of carnage and grief was blazed across Central America. I reported America's war against Nicaragua, which had the temerity to overthrow a Washington-backed dictator, Somoza. The CIA attacked Nicaragua with death squads, known as the Contra. Why did Washington attack such tiny countries? Because the weaker they are, the greater the threat. People who can free themselves against all the odds are sure to inspire others.
What right have you, when I mean you, the CIA, the United States government, or any foreign power, what right do you have to do what you do in other countries? What
national
right?
Security interests.
But that's a divine right, isn't it? Because the people that you do it to have no say in
this. Yeah. Well, that's just tough. We are going to protect ourselves, and we're going to go on protecting ourselves because we end up protecting all of you. And let's not forget that.
Right. No, I won't.
We'll intervene whenever we decide it's in our national security interest to intervene. And if you don't like it, lump it. Get used to it, world. We're not going to put up with nonsense. And if our interests are threatened, we're going to do it.
In Guatemala, the United Nations described the Washington-backed campaign against the Mayan people as genocide. An American Roman Catholic nun, Sister Diana Ortiz, experienced this at first hand as a missionary. In 1989, after speaking out about the brutal treatment of the indigenous people, she was kidnapped.
In 1989, November 2nd, I was abducted, and I was put in a police car, blindfolded, and taken to a military installation in Guatemala City, known as the Politecnica, which still exists today. I was taken to a basement, and I still remember to this day, upon entering the building, the clandestine prison, hearing the screams of people being tortured. Can you stop?
For 24 hours, she was tortured and gang raped. During her ordeal, she identified the leader of the gang as a fellow citizen of the United States.
I came out a totally different person. Yeah. But also with new eyes and more attuned to the hurting, the brokenness, the oppression, the deceit of my government. I've heard people say that what happened in Abu Ghraib is an isolated incident. And I have to just shake my head and say, you know, are we on the same planet? You know, aren't you aware of our history? You know, isn't history taught in the classroom about, you know, the role of the U.S. government in human rights violations.
By the late 1980s, Washington's policy changed. Dictators like Pinochet were seen as an unnecessary embarrassment. A new and innovative way of controlling nations was launched.
President Ronald Reagan.
Good morning and welcome. It's good to have you all here to help celebrate the launching of a program with a vision and a noble purpose. The National Endowment for Democracy is, just as we've been told, more than bipartisan. The establishment of the National Endowment goes right to the heart of America's faith in democratic ideals and institutions. It offers hope to people everywhere.
Like any new brand, it had a snappy name, democracy. It was largely fake, an illusion of marketing and spin. This brand of democracy meant that whoever you voted for, the policies would be broadly the same, and your country's economy would be in step with the United States. Washington would be your closest friend, or else. In the 1990s, these democracies in name replaced dictatorships in Latin America, with Chile providing the model. This is the commercial center of Santiago, Chile. On the surface today, everything seems normal, modern, prosperous. To the Bush administration, Chile is the very model of economic success. A laboratory experiment, according to the magazine Business Week. Much of life has been privatized. There are now billionaires, and the rich are getting richer.
Duane Claridge.
Pinochet fixed the country.
Who says? The United States says.
No. The World Bank says. The Inter-American Bank says. Everybody says it. He brought about an economic miracle in Chile. And I'm saying he had the brains for it, but he had the brains to hire all these people, Chileans, who had studied at the University of Chicago, who knew something about real economics.
Real economics were advocated by Milton Friedman, an extreme right-wing economist at the University of Chicago. Friedman was invited to perform his laboratory experiment on the economic life of Chile. The families of the tortured and disappeared were silent witnesses. Without irony, he called his experiment shock treatment.
Please be seated. Thank you all very much. It's an honor for me to be here to pay tribute to a hero of freedom, Milton Friedman. He has used a brilliant mind to advance a moral vision. We have seen Milton Friedman's ideas at work in Chile, where a group of economists called the Chicago Boys brought inflation under control and laid the groundwork for economic success.
This is the other side of the economic miracle. Chile today is a deeply unequal society. This shanty town is just minutes from Santiago's smart hotels.
Herminia Concha, former political prisoner. There are so many unemployed. There are thousands of unemployed. And those who work, their money isn't enough. So how can they pay for electricity? How can they pay for water? They have to buy gas. Everything must be paid for. Every day a mother asks, how am I going to feed the children? How can I afford it?
We found this couple living and freezing in the shantytown. They're homeless and have a week-old baby.
What's it like to live in these conditions? The cold at night is hardest for the baby. Do many people live like this in Chile? There are plenty, and many worse off than we are. They don't get help from anyone. Where will you go? Back to the streets. We've slept rough before. Abroad, in Europe and in the USA, it is said that life in Chile is rich and comfortable. Is that so? It's true for the well-off, but not for us.
Chile is a democracy now, in theory. A complicated voting system splits the vote and discourages real reform. It's a product of General Pinochet, based on a constitution that's also a product of Pinochet. The general may be dead, but the power of the military remains. It's all very modern, the media is safe, and many believe it's wise to be silent, like the graves of their forgotten compatriots. It's Washington's ideal democracy.
Felipe Portales, historian.
La dictadura tuvo un gran éxito.
The dictatorship was a great success in Chile, in that it established the political, economic, and social models that prevail to this day. Basically, the constitution imposed in 1980 has not been changed. Hermenia Concha, we don't belong to a democracy because that word has been so badly used. It's not understood. Here there is a persecution against the poor, and not just in Chile. This is happening all over Latin America. I think educated people realize that this is reaching a breaking point. I believe that people will wake up and say, that's enough.
This is Bolivia, another laboratory experiment. The majority of the population of this spectacular, brutalized country high in the Andes have also been invisible until recently. The indigenous people, the Aymara and Quechua, carry memories of a culture and civilization and wealth long before the Spanish arrived 500 years ago. They remember how a single hill of silver underwrote the entire Spanish Empire, while they became the poorest. This is the National Congress of Bolivia. Until recently, the faces here were almost all white, the descendants of a tiny Spanish elite which plundered the nation's riches and reduced the indigenous majority to serfdom. It was a pattern of control repeated all over Latin America. The pattern has been broken in Bolivia with the rise of social justice movements of a kind never seen before, and whose democratic home is not Westminster or Washington or any other so-called model, but in the streets, the mines, the barrios, the fields. Governments that defy this popular power, this true democracy, do so at their own peril. This is El Alto, the highest city on earth, and perhaps the poorest. The occupants of this cemetery on the roof of the world are mainly children, protected, they say, by the sacred mountain Illimanu. El Alto overlooks Bolivia's capital, La Paz. Juan Delfin, a priest and a taxi driver, has lived here for most of his life.
This is Villa Ingenio, the cemetery of northern El Alto. There is a sorrowful bitterness here. Our brothers, our children, our grandparents are dead and buried here. There was one family that poisoned themselves, the whole family, because of lack of work and lack of money. First, the husband poisoned his wife and children. Then he poisoned himself. We have seen cases like this.
When I first came to Bolivia in the 1960s, El Alto barely existed. The million people living here are peasants run off their land and miners made redundant by policies similar to those imposed in Chile. Infrastructure that didn't make a quick buck was privatized. The message was clear: sell it, strip it, or scrap it. The indigenous people were scrapped.
¿Por qué? Nos preguntamos.
Juan Delfín. We wonder, if I am a Bolivian, born rich, why am I begging? We had the sea, silver and gold. Why are we still suffering?
And yet the people here have held together their sense of identity, their community. In the year 2000, the people of Bolivia's second city, Cochabamba, fought an epic struggle to win back their most basic resource, water, from a foreign consortium dominated by the American corporation Bechtel. And they won. Three years later, in 2003, Bolivia's power brokers were about to get another shock. This is Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. Known as Goni, he was brought up in Washington. His English is better than his Spanish. They knew him here as El Gringo.
Isabel Atencio. I saw him as a fat man sitting on a golden chair, arrogant. Perhaps he was arrogant because of the power he had, which was his wealth.
When Goni was elected president of Bolivia in 2003, he backed a law that amounted to a fire sale of the country's resources. Almost everything was up for grabs, including Latin America's second biggest gas reserves.
Juan Delfín, we know we have gas, and it is being sold abroad to the almighty U.S. Yet still, I use wood for cooking. This is why the war started. We said, we will block, strike, and demonstrate until we get a response.
The people of El Alto fought back, blocking the roads leading into La Paz.
Isabel Atencio. There were calls to start blockades. Not even a fly would move. We stopped traffic and so on. But it gradually, what is the word? It gradually intensified.
Goni's response was the traditional Latin American way. He sent in the army to crush dissent. Scores were shot dead. Many were brought to Juan Delfín's church.
The tables were here. The bodies were here.
Y aquí es lo que incluso los muertos hasta con clavos le sacaron las balas.
They removed the bullets with nails, even. It was sad to see this.
Todos eran. Era lleno aquí. Puro doctores estaba lleno, estaba aquí.
The place was full. There were doctors everywhere. The smell of death was intense. All the orphans were crying and shouting.
Papa, papa, papa.
Tens of thousands of people poured down into La Paz, like the people of Venezuela's barrios demanding the return of their president. They demanded their country back. If the rich and powerful of Latin America had a nightmare, this was it.
Suddenly, we heard that Goni was about to resign. With one down, we felt inspired. It gave us strength. That was the aim, to make him resign.
Goni fled to the United States and is today living in a smart suburb of Washington. In October 2004, the Bolivian Congress ordered his arrest on charges of bloody massacre. George Bush has said, governments that harbor terrorists are as guilty as they are.
Pero toda esta oscuridad estamos así. El oscuro que nos ve. Toda la oscuridad.
This extraordinary mural was painted by Juan Delfin. It's a cry of freedom from an entire continent.
Todo mataron.
They killed us all. But we defend the Aymara people with the Potuto horn, with our voice, with our fist, with the flag. We wave the huipala against the United States. This is the United States flag. We're against this because they have put us in the situation we are in. The fist is very important. That's how we are. That's us.
In 2005, the people of Bolivia took an historic step. For the first time ever, an indigenous person was voted president in a landslide. Like Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales offered a new democracy and a new beginning.
Bolivian President Evo Morales.
Que todos
we ask everyone to start working. The party is over. The honeymoon is over. And it is over forever. For a new Bolivia.
Sin duda que está creciendo.
Hugo Chavez.
Se está propagando.
There is no doubt that it is growing. It is propagating itself all over the whole continent of Latin America, of the Caribbean too, but mainly South America. I go around Latin America, from Buenos Aires to Brasilia, Montevideo to La Paz. There is a fervor sparking off everywhere. There is a fervor.
In Latin America, there's now a host of leaders offering new beginnings. Of course, history is crowded with heroes who offer new beginnings. The respectability of great power and its games and deals and plunder always beckon. If these new leaders succumb, their biggest threat may not be from Washington, but from the people on the hillsides.
I was born. In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too. Beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Mariela Machado.
Futuro para mis hijos.
This isn't just Chavez's struggle, it's our struggle. What Chavez has unleashed is a recognition of this struggle. We are in it together, and we'll carry on fighting. So the empire's struggle isn't with Chavez, it's with us.
Llegó la hora del gran despertar.
Hugo Chavez.
Y creo que,
the great awakening has arrived. And I think Victor Hugo. Let's end with him. I'm with him on this. Victor Hugo wrote, "There is nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come." The American empire has reached its end, and the world must now be governed by the rule of law, of equality, of justice, of fraternity.
What happened here at the National Stadium in Santiago, Chile, has a special place in the struggle for freedom and democracy throughout Latin America and the world. The vow is never again, And yet it has happened again at Guantanamo Bay and all the other secret places where imperial power, regardless of its democratic pretensions, hides and tortures its perceived enemies. The questions raised in this film are urgent. Are the lives and dreams of the ordinary people of Chile, like the people of Venezuela, like the people of Bolivia, like the people of Nicaragua, like the people of Vietnam and Iraq and Iran and Palestine, expendable, worth only a few seconds on the news if they're lucky? The answer is no. And those who see the world through the eyes of the powerful should be warned. People are rising from the tyranny and oblivion to which we in the West have consigned them. Indeed, their resistance is well underway, as this film has shown. I would say it never stopped and is unbeatable.
I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there've been times that I thought I couldn't last for long. But now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know
listening to a radio adaptation of the 2007 film War on Democracy, written and directed and reported by John Pilger. I urge you to see this film if you can. Radio can't give you the full impact of this film, its beauty or its horror. John Pilger's website is johnpilger.com, P-I-L-G-E-R. But you can see it online at informationclearinghouse.info. Just search for John Pilger and War on Democracy. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We'll conclude with a selection that deals with MKUltra, the CIA's development of mind control and torture techniques, and the unwilling subjects whose lives were ruined by national security. This is an excerpt from Naomi Klein's most recent book, The Shock Doctrine.
The torture lab, Ewan Cameron, the CIA, and the maniacal quest to erase and remake the human mind. I don't talk to journalists anymore, says the strained voice at the other end of the phone, and then a tiny window. What do you want? I figure I have about 20 seconds to make my case, and it won't be easy. How do I explain what I want from Gail Kastner? The journey that brought me to her. The truth seems so bizarre. I am writing a book about shock, about how countries are shocked by wars, terror attacks, coup d'etat, and natural disasters, and then how they are shocked again by corporations and politicians who exploit the fear and disorientation of this first shock to push through economic shock therapy, and then how people who dare to resist this shock politics are, if necessary, shocked for a third time by police, soldiers, and prison interrogators. I want to talk to you because you are, by my estimation, among the most shocked people alive, being one of the few living survivors of the CIA's covert experiments in electroshock and other special interrogation techniques. And by the way, I have reason to believe that the research that was done on you in the 1950s at McGill University is now being applied to prisoners in Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. No, I definitely can't say that. So I say this instead. I recently traveled to Iraq, and I'm trying to understand the role torture is playing there. We are told it's about getting information, but I think it's more than that. I think it may also have to do with trying to build a model country, about erasing people and then trying to remake them from scratch. There is a long pause, and then a different tone of voice to the reply, still strained, but is it relief? You have just spelled out exactly what the CIA and Ewan Cameron did to me. They tried to erase and remake me, but it didn't work. In less than 24 hours, I am knocking on the door of Gail Kastner's apartment in a grim Montreal old age home. Gail had told me she would leave the door unlocked because standing up is difficult for her. It's the tiny fractures down her spine that grow more painful as arthritis sets in. Her back pain is just one reminder of the 63 times that 150 to 200 volts of electricity penetrated the frontal lobes of her brain, while her body convulsed violently on the table, causing fractures, sprains, bloody lips, broken teeth. Gail greets me from a plush blue recliner. It has 20 positions, I later learn, and she adjusts them continuously. It is in this chair that she spends her days and nights, searching for comfort, trying to avoid sleep, and what she calls my electric dreams. That's when she sees him, Dr. Ewan Cameron, the long-dead psychiatrist who administered those shocks, as well as other torments, so many years ago. Every single surface is crowded with towers of papers and books, precariously stacked but clearly in some kind of order, the books all marked with yellowing flags. The end table beside her chair is home to about 20 empty boxes of cigarettes. It looks as if Gail has colored the insides of the boxes black, but looking closer, I realize it is actually extremely dense, minuscule handwriting. Names, numbers, thousands of words. Gail often leans over to write something on a scrap of paper or a cigarette box. A note to myself, she explains, or I will never remember. For her entire adult life, Gail's mind has failed her. Facts evaporate instantly. Memories, if they are there, and many aren't, are like snapshots scattered on the ground. And so she makes lists. At first, she apologizes for the clutter. But later she says, "He did this to me. This apartment is part of the torture." For many years, Gail was quite mystified by her lack of memory, as well as other idiosyncrasies. She did not know, for instance, why a small electrical shock from a garage door opener set off an uncontrollable panic attack, or why her hands shook when she plugged in her hairdryer. Most of all, she could not understand why she could remember most events from her adult life, but almost nothing from before she turned 20. Gail figured it was all part of her shaky mental health. In her 20s and 30s, she had struggled with depression and addiction to pills, and would sometimes have such severe breakdowns that she would end up hospitalized and comatose. These episodes provoked her family to disown her, leaving her so alone and desperate that she survived by scavenging from the bins outside grocery stores. There had also been hints that something even more traumatic had happened early on. Before her family cut ties, Gail and her identical twin sister used to have arguments about a time when Gail had been much sicker and Zella had had to take care of her. "You have no idea what I went through," Zella would say. "You would urinate on the living room floor and suck your thumb and talk baby talk, and you would demand the bottle of my baby." But Gail had no memory of ever doing such strange things. In her late 40s, Gail began a relationship with a man named Jacob, whom she describes as her soulmate. Jacob was a Holocaust survivor, and he was also preoccupied with questions of memory and loss. For Jacob, who died more than a decade ago, Gail's unaccountably missing years were intensely troubling. "There has to be a reason," he would say about the gaps in her life. There has to be a reason. In 1992, Gail and Jacob happened to pass by a newsstand with a large sensational headline, "Brainwashing Experiments, Victims to be Compensated." Kastner started skimming the article, and several phrases immediately leaped out. Baby talk, memory loss, incontinence. Sitting in a nearby coffee shop, the couple read an incredible story about how, in the 1950s, the United States Central Intelligence Agency had funded a Montreal doctor to perform bizarre experiments on his psychiatric patients, keeping them asleep and in isolation for weeks, then administering huge doses of electroshock as well as experimental drug cocktails. The experiments, which reduced patients to pre-verbal infantile states, had been performed at McGill University's Allen Memorial Institute, under the supervision of its director, Dr. Ewan Cameron. The CIA's funding of Cameron had been revealed in the late 70s through a Freedom of Information Act request, sparking hearings in the U.S. Senate. Nine of Cameron's former patients got together and sued the CIA as well as the Canadian government, which had also funded Cameron's research. Over protracted trials, the patients' lawyers argued that the experiments had violated all standards of medical ethics. They had gone to Cameron seeking relief from minor psychiatric ailments, postpartum depression, anxiety, even for help to deal with marital difficulties, and had been used, without their knowledge or permission, as human guinea pigs to satisfy the CIA's thirst for information about how to control the human mind. In 1988, the CIA settled, awarding a total of $750,000 in damages to the nine plaintiffs. 4 years later, the Canadian government would agree to pay $100,000 in compensation to each patient who was part of the experiments. Like the free market economists, who are convinced that only a large-scale disaster, a great unmaking, can prepare the ground for their reforms, Cameron believed that by inflicting an array of shocks to the human brain, he could unmake and erase faulty minds, then rebuild new personalities on that ever-elusive, clean slate. I realized then that these people must have gone through the same thing I went through. I said, "Jacob, this has got to be the reason." Kastner wrote to the Allen and requested her medical file. At first, being told that they had no record of her, she finally got it. All 138 pages. The doctor who had admitted her was Ewan Cameron. The letters, notes, and charts in Gail's medical file tell a heartbreaking story. One as much about the limited choices available to an 18-year-old girl in the 50s as about governments and doctors abusing their power. The file begins with Dr. Cameron's assessment of Gail on her admittance. She is a McGill nursing student, excelling in her studies, whom Cameron describes as a hitherto reasonably well-balanced individual. She is, however, suffering from anxiety, caused, Cameron plainly notes, by her abusive father, an intensely disturbing man who made repeated psychological assaults on his daughter. In their early notes, the nurses seem to like Gail. She bonds with them about nursing, and they describe her as cheerful, sociable, and neat. But over the months she spent in and out of their care, Gail underwent a radical personality transformation. After a few weeks, she showed childish behavior, expressed bizarre ideas, and apparently was hallucinated and destructive. The notes report that this intelligent young woman could now manage to count only to six. Next, she is manipulative, hostile, and very aggressive. Then passive and listless, unable to recognize her family members. Her final diagnosis is schizophrenic with marked hysterical features, far more serious than the anxiety she displayed when she arrived. The metamorphosis no doubt had something to do with the treatments that are also all listed in Kastner's chart. Huge doses of insulin, inducing multiple comas, strange combinations of uppers and downers, long periods when she was kept in a drug-induced sleep, and eight times as many electroshocks as was standard at the time. Ewan Cameron, a Scottish-born American citizen, had reached the very pinnacle of his profession. He had been president of the American Psychiatric Association, president of the Canadian Psychiatric Association, and president of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, he was one of only three American psychiatrists asked to testify to the sanity of Rudolf Hess at the war crimes trials in Nuremberg. By the time Gail began her investigation, Cameron was long dead, but he had left dozens of academic papers and published lectures behind. Several books had also been published about the CIA's funding of mind control experiments, works that included plenty of detail about Cameron's relationship to the agency. According to his published papers from the time, he believed that the only way to teach his patients healthy new behaviors was to get inside their minds and break up old pathological patterns. The first step was de-patterning, which had a stunning goal: to return the mind to a state when it was, as Aristotle claimed, a writing tablet on which as yet nothing actually stands written, a tabula rasa. Cameron believed he could reach that state by attacking the brain with everything known to interfere with its normal functioning, all at once. It was shock and awe warfare on the mind. In dozens of clinical studies, doctors noted that in the immediate aftermath of treatment, patients sucked their thumbs, curled up in the fetal position, needed to be spoon-fed, and cried for their mothers. These behaviors usually passed quickly, but in some cases, when large doses of shock were used, doctors reported that their patients had regressed completely, forgetting how to walk and talk. To de-pattern his patients, Cameron used a relatively new device called the Page-Russell, which administered up to 6 consecutive jolts instead of a single one. Frustrated that his patients still seemed to be clinging to remnants of their personalities, he further disoriented them with uppers, downers, and hallucinogens. Once complete depatterning had been achieved, and the earlier personality had been satisfactorily wiped out, the psychic driving could begin. It consisted of Cameron playing his patients tape-recorded messages such as, "You are a good mother and wife, and people enjoy your company." As a behaviorist, he believed that if he could get his patients to absorb the messages on the tape, they would start behaving differently. With patients shocked and drugged into an almost vegetative state, they could do nothing but listen to the messages. For 16 to 20 hours a day, for weeks. In the mid-50s, several researchers at the CIA became interested in Cameron's methods. It was the start of the Cold War hysteria, and the agency had just launched a covert program devoted to researching what it called special interrogation techniques. A declassified CIA memorandum explained that the program examined and investigated numerous unusual techniques of interrogation, including psychological harassment and such matters as total isolation, as well as the use of drugs and chemicals. First codenamed Project Bluebird, then Project Artichoke, it was finally renamed MK-Ultra in 1953. Over the next decade, MK-Ultra would spend $25 million on research in a quest to find new ways to break prisoners suspected of being communists and double agents. 80 institutions were involved in the program, including 44 universities and 12 hospitals. The agents involved had no shortage of creative ideas for how to extract information from people who would rather not share it. The problem was finding ways to test those ideas. If word got out that the CIA was testing dangerous drugs on American soil, the entire program could be shut down, which is where the CIA's interest in Canadian researchers came in. The relationship dates back to June 1, 1951, and a tri-national meeting of intelligence agencies and academics at Montreal's Ritz-Carlton Hotel. The subject of the meeting was growing concern in the Western intelligence community that the communists had somehow discovered how to brainwash prisoners of war. The evidence was the fact that American GIs taken captive in Korea were going before cameras, seemingly willingly, and denouncing capitalism and imperialism. One of those at the Ritz meeting was Dr. Donald Hebb, director of psychology at McGill University. According to the declassified minutes, Hebb, trying to unlock the mystery of the GI confessions, speculated that the communists might be manipulating prisoners by placing them in intensive isolation and blocking input to their senses. The intelligence chiefs were impressed, and 3 months later, Hebb had a research grant from Canada's Department of National Defense to conduct a series of classified sensory deprivation experiments. Hebb paid a group of 63 McGill students $20 a day to be isolated in a room wearing dark goggles, headphones playing white noise, and cardboard tubes covering their arms and hands so as to interfere with their sense of touch. To see whether this deprivation made them more susceptible to brainwashing, Hebb then began playing recordings of voices talking about the existence of ghosts or the dishonesty of science, ideas the students had said they found objectionable before the experiment began. In a confidential report on Hebb's findings, the Defense Research Board concluded that sensory deprivation clearly caused extreme confusion as well as hallucinations among the student test subjects, and that a significant temporary lowering of intellectual efficiency occurred during and immediately after the period of perceptual deprivation. Furthermore, the students' hunger for stimulation made them surprisingly receptive to the ideas expressed on the tapes, and indeed several developed an interest in the occult that lasted weeks after the experiment had come to an end. A copy of Hebb's major study was sent to the CIA, as well as 41 copies to the U.S. Navy and 42 copies to the U.S. Army. Hebb's report noted that four of the subjects remarked spontaneously that being in the apparatus was a form of torture, which meant that forcing them to stay past their threshold, 2 or 3 days, would clearly violate medical ethics. Aware of the limitations this placed on the experiment, Hebb wrote that more clear-cut results were not available because it is not possible to force subjects to spend 30 to 60 days in conditions of perceptual isolation. Not possible for Hebb, but it was perfectly possible for his McGill colleague and academic arch-rival, Dr. Ewan Cameron. As for consent, his patients were at his mercy. The standard consent form endowed Cameron with absolute power to treat, up to, and including performing full frontal lobotomies. As the CIA dollars poured in, the Allen Memorial Institute seemed less like a hospital and more like a macabre prison. But where Hebb's students fled less intense sensory deprivation after only a couple of days, Cameron kept his patients in for weeks, with one of them trapped in the isolation box for 35 days. Cameron's work was funded by the CIA until 1961, and for many years it wasn't clear what, if anything, the U.S. government did with his research. In the late 70s and 80s, when proof of the CIA's funding for the experiments finally came out in Senate hearings, journalists and legislators tended to accept the CIA's version of events. That it was conducting research into brainwashing techniques in order to protect captured U.S. soldiers. Most of the press attention focused on the sensational detail that the government had been funding acid trips. In fact, a large part of the scandal, when it finally broke, was that the CIA and Ewan Cameron had recklessly shattered lives with their experiments for no good reason. Everyone knew by then that brainwashing was a Cold War myth. When John Gittinger, the CIA psychologist who first reached out to Cameron, was forced to testify before a joint Senate hearing, he called the support for Cameron a foolish mistake, a terrible mistake. In 1988, the New York Times ran a groundbreaking investigation into U.S. involvement in torture and assassinations in Honduras. Florencio Caballero, an interrogator with Honduras's notoriously brutal Battalion 316, told the Times that he and 24 of his colleagues were taken to Texas and trained by the CIA. They taught us psychological methods to study the fears and weaknesses of a prisoner. Make him stand up, don't let him sleep, keep him naked and isolated, put rats and cockroaches in his cell, give him bad food, serve him dead animals, throw cold water on him, change the temperature. There was one technique he failed to mention: electroshock. Inez Murillo, a 24-year-old prisoner who was interrogated by Caballero and his colleagues, told the Times that she was electrocuted so many times that she screamed and fell down from the shock. "The screams just escape you," she said. "I smelled smoke and realized I was burning from the singes of the shocks. They said they would torture me until I went mad. I didn't believe them. But then they spread my legs and stuck the wires on my genitals." Murillo also said that there was someone else in the room, an American passing questions to her interrogators, whom the others called Mr. Mike. The revelations led to hearings of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, where the CIA's deputy director, Richard Stoltz, confirmed that Caballero did indeed attend a CIA human resources exploitation or interrogation course. Finally, under threat of a lawsuit, and 9 years after the original story was published, the CIA produced a handbook called Kubark Counterintelligence Interrogation. The handbook is a 128-page secret manual on the interrogation of resistant sources that is heavily based on the research commissioned by MKUltra, and Ewan Cameron's and Donald Hebb's experiments have left their marks all over it. Methods range from sensory deprivation to stress positions, from hooding to pain. It represents a new age of precise, refined torture, not the gory, inexact torment that had been the standard since the Spanish Inquisition. In a kind of preface, the manual states, "The intelligence service, which is able to bring pertinent modern knowledge to bear upon its problems, enjoys huge advantages over a service which conducts its clandestine business in 18th century fashion." What follows is a how-to guide on dismantling personalities. The manual describes several of the techniques that were honed to de-pattern patients in the basement of the Allen Memorial Institute. What most captured the imagination of Kubark's authors more than any individual technique was Cameron's focus on regression. The idea that by depriving people of their sense of who they are and where they are in time and space, adults can be converted into dependent children whose minds are a blank slate of suggestibility. Prisoners are captured in the most jarring and disorienting way possible, late at night or in early morning raids, as the manual instructs. They are immediately hooded or blindfolded, stripped and beaten, then subjected to some form of sensory deprivation. And from Guatemala to Honduras, Vietnam to Iran, the Philippines to Chile, the use of electroshock is ubiquitous. In 1966, the CIA sent three psychiatrists to Saigon, armed with a Page Russell, the same kind of electroshock machine favored by Cameron. It was used so aggressively that it killed several prisoners. For U.S. intelligence officials, that kind of hands-on approach was rare. From the 70s on, the role favored by American agents was that of mentor or trainer, not direct interrogator. Testimony from Central American torture survivors in the 70s and 80s is littered with references to mysterious English-speaking men walking in and out of cells proposing questions or offering tips. Though sanctioned by successive administrations in Washington, the U.S. role in these dirty wars had to be covert, for obvious reasons. Simply put, what they were teaching was illegal. If anyone asked, U.S. agents were tutoring their developing world students in modern professional policing methods. On September 11, 2001, that long-time insistence on plausible deniability went out the window. The terrorist attack on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon was a different kind of shock from the ones imagined in the pages of the Kubark manual, but its effects were remarkably similar. Profound disorientation, extreme fear and anxiety, and collective regression.
That was an excerpt from The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism by Naomi Klein. I apologize to local listeners. WEOS apparently failed to broadcast last week's show on deep politics with Peter Dale Scott. However, you can download it and all episodes of Unwelcome Guests at unwelcomeguests.org.